Good morning. Today I have the honor of talking to Reuben George of the Tsleil Waututh Coast Salish Wolf Clan, discussing his book, It Stops Here, Standing Up for Our Lands, Our Water, and Our People. Reuben talks about his personal battles of anger and alcohol due to generational trauma of residential schools in Canada, and how ceremonies of smudging, sweat lodges, and sun dances made him the warrior that he is today. He stands for the environment, and that led him to take on the legal fight of stopping the expansion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline, fighting to preserve the waters of his home, the Burrard Inlet, since 2010. Reuben reminds all of us of the importance of connection, finding our spirit, and to be the best version of ourselves for our family, community, and this planet. Welcome, Reuben George of the Tsleil Waututh Coast Salish Wolf Clan. I just finished reading your book, It Stops Here, Standing Up for Our Lands, Our Water, and Our People. And I loved one of the lines in your book. It stayed with me all through the book, and it stayed with me since I finished it. It was rough, but it was beautiful. And I think that one line kind of summed up for me everything that you wrote and everything that you stand for. And I think for our listeners to understand, you're taking on this battle with the Trans Mountain Pipeline and its expansion and preserving the waters of the Burrard Inlet. You've been fighting this since 2010. I think it's really important for our listeners, first of all, to understand why.
Well, Tsleil Waututh means people the water around Vancouver. And as the story goes, our legend that our first mother comes from the water from around Vancouver. So that's essentially our grandmother. So we, and through that, we grew to have a reciprocal relationship to the water there through ceremony, through fishing, through everything. And so, you know, and also that's one reason, but another reason is in every ceremony I've been to around the world, you know, in South America, Central America, Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand, and even the local, like I did ceremony with rabbis and priests and Baha'i and Muslim, everything. But they all do things in common. In their ceremonies, they use something to represent the energy of the sun, something to represent earth, something to represent water, something to represent air. And through that process, when you use those different elements to pray, you learn to create a reciprocal relationship to those things. When you use them in prayer, it's things that we can't live without. And so when you gain something like that, like, and you start to care for it through ceremony and a spiritual connection to it, it just follows suit to want to do something for it and protect it and enhance it, take care of it, because those elements take care of us. So it's just makes sense to protect what we love, and that's why we stand up against TMX Pipeline.
One of the things I loved in your book was the history of your family, and I would hope most of our listeners will know your grandfather, Chief Dan George. I remember watching him as a child, and he was one of the few, if only, Indigenous actors at the time that became a familiar face. And reading the book, he was a huge influence on you and your life, and I loved the poem that you included, Words to a Grandchild. Can you talk about your grandfather and his story and his influence on you and who you've become?
I think it was pretty incredible. Like, I know he made movies and did books and he was famous that way, but he was pretty cultural and pretty spiritual and really loved the land and the water and everything. And but he's our babysitter when I was younger. I remember his manager and Colin tried to send a limo to pick us up to go to the dentist, and we're like, yay. And we said, no, we'll catch the bus. And we did. We caught the bus. He took us, even though he's so famous, we'd catch the bus. And he's just a common person and didn't live rich, even though he had lots of money. He lived very, very humble and didn't need much in the monetary sense, and because he was rich with his children and lots of grandchildren, and he loved the land, he loved the water, he loved the people. He's huge humanitarian. I got a plaque right beside me that says honorary member of the Christian Jewish faith. And, you know, he'd say things like, and I put that in the book, was, you know, it doesn't matter what religion or spirituality you follow, as long as you're good at it. Those fundamentals of humanity, of love and honor and respect and dignity, pride, compassion, understanding, truth, knowledge, wisdom, bravery, and courage. Those are the foundations of how we're supposed to raise our kids. And he'd say, in the cultural and spiritual teachings that come out of any religious and spiritual teaching are those things. He said, if you're good at that, there's no problem with us having a good prayer with each other. And that's what he did. I do the same thing. Like I could pray with anyone. When you come to my house, we'll pray my way. When I go to your house, I'm happy to pray your way. And he was an environmentalist, a humanitarian with human rights, and he's a political leader. He's a whole bunch of different things. And he, one thing about him is he never stopped. Till the day he died, he was working to protect our lands, water, and human rights.
And I think what's interesting, looking at his life, is his name, Chief Dan George. George wasn't his last name. That was something he acquired through residential school. And I think that the fact that he had still such, like you said, a love and humanitarian look at the world, forgiveness, considering his start, I think that's a big statement of who he is and who he was, because a lot of people would carry anger, and he didn't seem to carry that. And I know, you know, your family was definitely impacted by residential schools throughout your whole family. Can you talk about that and how it created your own battles that you had to deal with and your own demons that you had to deal with?
Well, it was intergenerational. I don't put this in the book, but when he was born in 1899, and he went to residential school in 1904. He didn't speak any English. He lived in a communal longhouse, and he went to school, and because he spoke his language, they cut off his finger when he's like five. And there was a lot of horrible things happened there, and there's no nice way of saying it, with the nuns and priests and the government did to indigenous people. You know, like my mom, he witnessed murders and little children in residential school, and he himself got abused. But what's incredible to me, like, even though it was like that, and then the aftermath of living in a racist community where Canada was still suppressing, he was incredibly able to hold on to our cultural and our spiritual teachings, healed himself and do the best he could, and became the beautiful leader that he was. You know, the intergenerational pain, when you go through something like that, the oppressed become the oppressors, and that happened across Canada, where the abuse in some indigenous communities was pretty bad because the intergenerational pain was passed on. But even though, also that studies show that you don't have to go through what your parents been through to feel like that you experienced it. Maybe it comes out in different ways, like anxiety and depression. Like, those things are passed on. So when that's passed on, I explain this in the book. Like, you know, I did family therapy for years, but I don't practice full time anymore. I've been doing environmental work and business stuff. But that we could deal with things in society, how it works, mental, emotional, and physical trauma. That's how we deal with it. But we don't look at it spiritually. And that intergenerational trauma is like the spiritual trauma. I explain this, that love has a spirit. Every single culture in the whole wide world, when two people fall in love, do a ceremony to honor that love between two people, and they call it marriage. And so that's a positive thing, of two people coming together creating a spirit of love. But two people can come together and create a spirit of trauma. That's what I believe. So when he went to residential school, and the things that he witnessed, some weren't dealt with, some were passed on to my mom, even though she may have not have gone through some of the same things he did, but then she went through her own trauma. But if they both didn't deal with it, then it's passed on to me. And so there's the intergenerational trauma that's passed on, and that's what we deal with in ceremony. In ceremony, we recognize that trauma, we see that spirit, and we face and we get rid of it. We get rid of it in ceremonies and the sweat lodges and all the West Coast ceremonies that I do and the sun dances that I do. It created a huge change in my life. And that's what they did. That's what my mom did, and that's what my grandpa did. But, you know, it's like some things fall through the cracks and some things are passed on. And that's what we see today. That's what I see. And some of those things are still like that. You know, I was director of community development for Tsleil-Waututh, like 13, 14 years ago. And when you lived on a reservation, you got, for example, in social assistance, you got $120 a month living on reserve. But if you lived off reserve, you got $550 to $1,200 a month. I don't know if it's still exact those numbers, and I know inflation and all that changed things, but it was bad. They just give enough for people to fail. I don't see how anybody could eat on $120 a month. But when you're coming out of a place of oppression, intergenerational pain, and it's hard to pop out of those things. But that's just an example. And if you don't mind, I could jump into something else. That's just an example of Indigenous community and oppression. But I see that in every walk of life. I see the lack of spirit in people in the world. And I did international work at United Nations. I worked with different nations in different countries. And it's the same problem. If we had a connection to spirit, a reciprocal relation to spirit, and, you know, we come to ceremony. It doesn't matter what kind of ceremony you go to. If it's done right, you should leave feeling joyous. If it's not and it's disrespectful, you have a right to leave. You have a right to leave any ceremony that feels disrespectful. But if it's done right, you should leave feeling joyous. Connection to the people that you're praying with spiritually. Connecting to the words that they're saying. My grandpa would say, speak so your words fall down into the hearts of the people you're listening to, that are listening to you. Speak so your words fall down in their hearts. And that's like in a ceremony. You want those teachings to fall down to the hearts and help people heal and leave feeling better. I know 90% of the people come to my ceremonies, they leave feeling better and spiritually uplifted. And if that's the case, you have a responsibility with that, and that's to share it. So you created a reciprocal relationship of spirit with the people in there, and you leave feeling better, and you share some of that. But the more you do that, the more you become your own individual with your own individual thoughts, and the more you see, and the more you'll see in the goodness, but then you'll start to see the badness. And that's like, we wouldn't make decisions on like we do with fossil fuels and the destruction that it causes and how it changes things, or we'd start to see that 60% of mammals have died. What's left of that 60%, 65% is livestock. The salmon and the fish. In 10 years, no edible fish come under the ocean. You know, when we see those things, we'd want to create change. So in your first question, why am I doing what I'm doing? That's a longer explanation of why I'm doing what I'm doing. I have a responsibility that the joy, that ceremony, I get out of ceremony, that I want to create change. I want things to be better. We start to think of our future generations because it looks bleak. If I have a grandchild right now, what is it going to be like in 10 years? What are the floods going to look like? What are the natural disasters going to look like? You know, I think of it, and insurance companies are going to be the one that are screwed first, because how could they keep up with that demand of the fires? There's 400 fires at one time here in British Columbia. And the sad thing is, it's not going to get any better. It's not. It's not the new norm. At the rate we're going, it's gonna be more disasters. But what I'm saying is, we're connected to spirit and stuck to our individual self. Like, I put this in a book. My son was in grade 2, and his like principal called and said, "Oh, your son made the teacher cry." And I said, "Oh no." I got down there, And the teacher and the principal, everyone's sitting there, and I said, what happened? They started telling me. I said, no, I'm asking my son what happened. He said, Dad, I told her, I said, I'm going to keep misbehaving until you kick me out of this class. And I said, why? And he goes, Dad, don't make me a robot. He was serious.
That's fantastic, like, yeah.
He's like, don't make me a robot. And these kids do everything the same.
Yeah.
They're not them. They're not being their individual selves. And I said, yeah, you're right. I took them out of that school. It was a private school. And I took them out and put them with all Native kids, and he thrived. And, you know, I'm happy I did that. They are their individual selves. But I look at that because my daughter stayed in that private school. And they teach them different. And I saw that right away, just hanging around there and making sure my daughter's getting a good education or whatever, but she's smart. She graduated at 15, went to university at 15. And I was watching, and not in, like in public school, they say, if you're really smart, you could be a doctor or lawyer. But here they're saying, no, they didn't come out and say it. But they're saying, you know, you're going to be rich and wealthy and run things like your parents. 32 kids she started school with, and 32 kids she graduated. Every single one of those kids took political science and business. Be rich and wealthy politicians like your parents and run things. We're taught what we could do and how we do it, and stay in our silo of our circle that supports our how we are in our community. Instead of, you know, in my ceremony, if I'm not teaching you to surpass me, I'm failing. And I'm glad to say a lot of people who've been coming for a long time, a lot of them surpassed me, and they're doing really good in their careers and their life and their families and their marriages, and they're finding their gifts. And that's what we want, is people to find their gifts. That's what my son was saying. Don't make me a robot like everybody else. And that goes along with the saying too, is the lack of creating that lack of spirit. We're told what to think, and then we watch media and they tell us what to think too. Tell us how to be. Tell us how to vote. Do we work for bad or worse? And do they have the best interest in their mind? No, I don't think so. I don't think government do. They support what they always been supporting. Yeah.
One of the things I loved in your book as well is, like, you've had influence from your grandfather and your mother and from the community, but you also had a huge influence from Leonard Crow Dog, a Lakota spiritual leader, who taught you the Sundance. And I know you took your time. He offered it to you when you were younger and you felt you didn't want to do it until you were ready. Can you talk, like, a lot of people have maybe heard that expression but have really no idea what a Lakota Sundance is really like, what that experience is like, and how it transformed you?
Well, first, they taught me how to smudge. And the smudge, you have, you know, everything, fire, earth, water, and sky. You got an abalone shell to represent water, and the feather to represent air, and matches to fire, and then sage, sweetgrass, tobacco for earth. And they teach you all the things around that. And they teach you pipe ceremony. A bowl is a stone and like a pipe. And then you put tobacco in it, and that represents woman. Then the stem is wood. And you put it together to the pipe, and that's teaching the man and woman. Then you learn sweat lodge, and sweat lodge is a cleansing ceremony, and, you know, it's like a tent, and it's really dark inside, and you bring in some red hot lava rocks and pour water on it, and you meditate. And then the vision quest, you know, you pray for the vision of your life, for a direction for you to go in, and you fast for 40 days and 4 nights and pray up on a mountain. And then when you learn all those things, we'll introduce you to a Sundance, which is a 4-day prayer of dancing for 4 days and about 12, 16 hours a day, and no food, no water. And the idea behind that is you're not nourishing your body with food or water, but you're nourishing your spirit with prayer. And when that's done right, you know, and people do it right, what happens is you end up higher state of spiritual consciousness. So that's a Sundance. So it's a 4-day ceremony, and it's beautiful. You know, I went to South Dakota, drove down there for about 20 years, and it really helped me enlighten myself to be a better human being. Those ceremonies, once it became part of it, I went to my first sweat, and I was like, I have some pretty big problems. My girlfriend at that time, She goes, every time I go to hug you, you push me away. And I said, no, I don't. And at that moment, she went to hug me, and I pushed her. And I was so rough around the edges, like even physical touch from the woman that I loved, you know, I'd push away because of my hurt and pain and trauma. And, you know, in the first wet, I came out, and two guys were standing there, and they just hugged me. The first time in years that I hugged somebody like that. And, you know, and it just healed tremendously. So since then, since 1993, I've been sweating every week, sometimes a couple times a week, sometimes three times a week, and it's helped. But that led me to the Sundance, and the Sundance changed my life, achieving the higher state of spiritual consciousness, knowing a bit of what heaven's like, you know. And just like my family before me who passed away, they talked to me like my grandfather. When he's passing away, he said, don't cry for me. I know where I'm going. I've been there. All my family has come to get me. My wife's there, and she's coming to get me, my grandparents, and I miss them. I want to be with them, and I want to leave. And he said, so don't cry because you hold me here. And then he passed away that night. And all my cousins passed away like that. All of them. Not all of them, most of them. And it's because of some of the ceremonies that we do, we experience a little bit of heaven. And that's what Sundance taught me. It really taught me. And you know, I love Crow Dog. And I went back last year for the first time in 8 years because I run my own Sundance up here in British Columbia. And, you know, it's 12 days altogether, and we get there 4 days before, 4 days after the actual ceremony. We prepare and closing down the ceremony. But I went back home to my adopted home in South Dakota and danced there. So I did two this year and danced with Leonard Crow Dog Jr. And such a beautiful ceremony that helps so many people. Because of Crow Dog, there's a lot of Sundances, and there's one in Europe and a couple in Mexico, South America. Like it's, and he has about five or six from him in North America. So he spread his teachings wide and far. And like my grandpa, he was so giving and giving and giving. And like my grandpa, till the day he died, he was in service and helping the people in the lands and waters.
Let's move forward to 2010 when you first took on your big battle with the Trans Mountain Pipeline. Can you talk about how that started and how you got involved and the change that made in your life? Because it wasn't your background, and you took a big step forward to do this.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember I went to a meeting in West Vancouver here and they talked. They wanted some Indigenous help, and my spiritual father, Phil Lane Jr., invited me to this meeting. And my best bud, Curtis, listened. Him and I listened to everything. We're the last two speakers, and Curtis, yep, I'd die to stop this. I was like, oh geez, what did you get us into? So I said, okay, we'll help you, and then, you know, I remember our first town hall meeting. One of the first things we did with Burnaby, and we sent out hundreds and hundreds of flyers, and just a handful of people showed up. But a couple of years later, it got to the degree that 71% of Burnaby residents supported the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, and soon Canada had to stop them because they didn't consult us. And then I remember, too, after about a year, it was just me. But then we brought it to Tsleil-Waututh to the community, and we did a referendum, and 100% of the people said, no, we're going to stop it. And then the CEO of Tsleil-Waututh, she came in my office and she goes, hey, you started this stuff, so I want to second you as the executive director of community development to manager of the, we have to give it a name, of what turned into Sacred Trust to stop the pipeline. And I said, oh, geez. And then, of course, you said that. All those things came into my mind. Well, I'm good at what I do. I help people and do family therapy. I run the programs from babies to elders. I like this work and I'm familiar with it. And this is out of my element. I'm not an expert at it. I have no education on it. And then I called my kids real quick, and they're young back then. They're only like 14 and 12 or something, or 13 and 11. And I phoned them really quick, and I got to talk to them really quick because my boss gave me, she goes, I give you 2 hours to decide. And I was like, big career changing decision. And so I talked to my kids. I went home really quick, and I said, told them what my boss said, and I said, what do you think? So might not be as good, I don't know. And they looked at me and they said, we could beat him, Daddy. No, that changed everything. And so I went back and I said, okay, I'll fight it. I'll help you lead it. And that was that.
And you, that was in 2012 when you formed the Sacred Trust. And then a year later, you gathered all these international indigenous leaders and you met in South Dakota and you signed the international treaty to protect the sacred from the tar sands. What was that like, and how did you feel that having more of a support group from other indigenous groups to have the same values and fight the same fight? How did that impact you, and what was the importance of that?
Well, first, there's the American Indian Movement leaders that Sundance, a few of them, Leonard Krodock Sundance, and I went to talk to Casey Kemp. I work with her today. She does a lot of amazing work. She's my spiritual auntie, but her late brother who passed away was so instrumental and spiritually and everything. And I went to him and I said, hey, how do I do this? And he goes, get the people support first. And that's what we did in Tsleil-Waututh. Then we worked on locally, regionally, Canada, and then I said, okay, now let's go do international things. So we did. We went to on Yankton, South Dakota, and had it was interesting because there was a Pawnee and Lakota were the main two nations that we invited, but there's, you know, Chief Gerald Bob from Stotlium and Lummi Nation and a whole bunch from everywhere. They came, and it was because we, in Carter Camp, he said, when you do things, make sure you pray before everything. And so did my Uncle Len. So did actually all my teachers, spiritual teachers. They said, pray. So we had a 5-day conference. But the first 2 days we spoke of no business. We just did ceremony. We did ceremony to recognize our collective law. The Tsleil-Waututh law, truth, family, health, and culture is essentially the law of our culture and spirituality. And that's how we run things in Tsleil-Waututh. So it's the same with all these other nations. We just did pray together, and that turned into our spiritual law. And I remember a really good friend, beautiful lawyer, Jen Baker. She helped with us, and Ben West came down, and we helped write this document. And we said we want the Lakota and Pawnee to find first, and the Pawnee are going, why? Why us? Why? I don't know. Historically, in every TV movie show or whatever, it's always the Pawnee and Lakota fighting. And you guys used to be like that, but, you know, you've been allies a lot of the time, too. But if you come together and sign this, it shows a lot. But people could put anything aside and work with each other, and that'd be a powerful message. And they said, okay, we'll sign it. And we signed it. But that was neat because when we prayed for the 2 days, who led ceremony was Krodock and Orville Lickenhorst. They're two iconic. Orville's still doing beautiful work down in South Dakota, but it was two iconic spiritual leaders that do great work and globally that led the first 2 days of ceremony. But it was good. It sort of opened the doors to the international work that we're doing and we continue to do.
Going back to Canada, you've had to fight with Harper's government and then forwarding into Trudeau's government, and you probably had some different expectations with Trudeau just because he campaigned so much on environmental issues and Indigenous rights. I would think you probably went in thinking you had more of an ally there than you did with Harper, but that didn't really go that way. after the National Energy Board's hearing, you know, when Trudeau said if he got elected, he would do a review. Can you talk about that and how you felt going in and then with what happened once Trudeau was actually elected?
I remember we actually paid for some billboards to be put up to in some of the busier places in Vancouver, paid for them, and, you know, supporting Trudeau. I didn't like it. I don't trust any government. I can, you know, the good, good or bad, you know, it's like in British Columbia, it was the bad guys that we always made deals with, significant deals in British Columbia, and the NDP was the good guys, and until recently, there's no significant deal that they did historically, but now they do. Now they do. But so it's hard to trust. And but the thing is, I don't, you know, we could be at the opposite end of the tables of some things, but we could work on some things together. That's how it has to be. And Trudeau was making all these promises. My mom is even happy and she's voting for him. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to vote. Just the same. Yes. And so, you know, he got in and it was brutal, you know. But I think, like Obama, when Obama got in, everyone was so happy. Truth is, he sold more artillery in his last year than George Bush did in 8 years. And I think the people that have been running things still ran them. And I think Trudeau possibly would have all those things that he wanted to do, he did want to do. But when he got in there, he found out he doesn't really run anything. It's the same people running things, still run things, and that became evident what he's doing around the pipeline. It didn't make sense to buy it. That was his way out when Kinder Morgan left. He could have said, okay, and that's it. But no, he bought it for, you know, $1 billion more than what they spent. And so it started in deficit. And then, yeah, it's just a nightmare all the way through. So he went to the United Nations not long after, and he stood up there in front of the world and said, "Canada's back. We're going to make a difference. We're going to do change." And at the COP, at the environmental conference, and we are the first nation in Canada to meet with him that I knew of, in his cabinet, more his cabinet, and we went in there and they're like, "Let's build the pipeline." And we're like, no, my chief would say no. And they're like, let's build the pipeline. My chief's like, no. And it was just like literally like that almost. And then our lawyer, he texted my chief, my auntie, and texted me and said, let Ruben give it to him. Then my auntie looked at me and said, you got something to say? And I said, sure. I said, I was in the United Nations when Trudeau stood up there and said, Canada's back. And you made all these environmental promises. I said, the worst kept secret in Canada is that you're going to make a decision tomorrow around this pipeline, which doesn't match the agreement that you made with us, that you're going to consult us before you did that. That's the worst kept secret, that you're going to make an announcement tomorrow, not just this pipeline, but other pipelines. And all your campaign promises that you did and what you said at United Nations, all that's nullified by approving one of these pipelines. And then you broke our agreement too, so you're lying. I said, outside those doors is a press conference that we already called because we know already what you're going to do. And we're going to go out there and call you a bunch of liars that what you are. And I remember when I started, I said, Canada's back. Trudeau stood up there. They're all smiling. Yeah. And then when I said those things, they quit smiling right away. And then they're like, okay, meeting's over. I said, I'm right, meeting's over.
That all happened pretty quickly. Did you get any warning or noticed that that was going to happen? You probably thought you had a victory and it looked like Kinder Morgan was going to back down. Did you have any idea that they were going to step in and form this Crown Corporation?
We had some inclinations of that, and we hear things, you know, on every level of government, I know somebody, or my family knows somebody. It was sad because here's a crazy story. I don't know if I put this in the book. I can't remember. But the day that it sold, when Kinder Morgan left, it was, we had hope too, even when that sold. like kicking Kinder Morgan out of her country. But my mom and a bunch of elders and the Grand Chief of British Columbia, Uncle Stuart Phillips, that's when they're arresting people at the Kinder Morgan, anyone interfering with it. So they went to get arrested. They went and got a whole bunch of launchers, and all the elders put their chairs out, about 30 of them or 20 of them or something, and they sat right in front of the Kinder Morgan gate and said, nobody's going to work today. And then the police came up, because there's like 40 media there or something, and the police came up and they said, hey, they asked us not to arrest you, so we're not arresting anyone today. So we're like, oh, geez. Okay. And a big thunder just roared just after they said, just thunder. I never heard such a loud thunder. And everyone started looking at their phones, and they went, oh, my God, look. I said, they're gone. Kinder Morgan's gone. We beat him. And it was a celebration just at that moment. Thunder came, and it was a celebration. But then it turned into a disaster for Canada and the taxpayers, because we went to court the second time, and we explained the economics of it. It's brutal. That it doesn't make money, make sense for First Nations, for British Columbia, for Canada, for anybody. It just doesn't make sense, and we explained that. And the Federal Court of Appeal judges said, Tsleil-Waututh, you're right. Canada's wrong, but we're still going to side with the best interests of Canada. And you look at it today, and it's like to put a barrel of oil through any other pipeline that costs around $10 or $11. That's how much it costs to transport one barrel of oil. And that's what this company does. This pipeline, that's all it does, is transport oil. And for this pipeline, because it costs $32 billion, it's going to cost $23 to put one barrel of oil through. So what they're going to do is they're going to subsidize somebody. They're going to pay somebody $12 per barrel, almost a billion barrels a day, to go through this pipeline and subsidize them. And it looks like it's going to work out to about $16 billion to pay somebody to use this pipe, right? So who does the service? And when you think that way, it doesn't make sense from the beginning. And then their own estimations of what they said when they put in the application to build this pipeline, they said it would take 20 years to pay off the $7 billion debt. And it keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And so Trudeau, big, 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 big mistake. And I don't know, when elections come, if the conservatives will use it against them, but, you know, it's a nightmare. And, you know, we did our own independent 1,200-page assessment of this pipeline. We did a spill analysis, the clean analysis. We did multiple economic studies because the price per barrel fluctuated so much. And it's all working with world-renowned scientists and world-renowned economists. You know, it's just crazy, the work that we put into it. And then the beginning, because it just was so disastrous that it kept me up at night in the beginning. It's just all these thoughts in my mind of the destruction that it causes. And Exxon Valdez, over 30 years later, it's still a mess. Look at the Gulf of Mexico, still a mess. And they still continue, and they still push. And the likeliness of a spill here is over 80%. So, you know, as Kinder Morgan, I remember the way we jumped through so many hoops, more than any other history of any pipeline application in Canada. And we're like, damn right you did. And what can make everybody do this? Your outdated 1950 policies don't match. Because you had these policies, look at the destruction it caused to the world. You know, I started a hydrogen company, and it's simple. We build an engine. We take the water molecule and split it. We take the H2O. We take the hydrogen away from the oxygen, and then we store the hydrogen. We put it in put it as fuel into an engine, and then when it goes to the engine, it adds the oxygen back to the hydrogen, and energy comes out of that. So it's turning back into water, and that's what comes out of the engine, opposed to carbon monoxide. So it's like, it's a no-brainer, but we're still stuck in this. We're still stuck in this. Like, and electric cars are really good, and I think it's a step in the right direction, but then you got some problems with the mining and things like that. And but here, hydrogen, it's just water coming out. And, you know, it's just crazy that we're stuck thinking that the way we do is, again, I go back to, you know, my first comments is, if we had our individual thought and we were connected to our spirit, our own individual spirit, our ancestors, and some way to pray, don't have to pray my way. I said, my grandpa said, it doesn't matter, Catholic, Christian, Muslim, doesn't matter if you're good at it, we could pray together and let's make a difference. But if we're awake too, we would see the world and we'd want to make a difference. You know, and I think the hydrogen's going to go well for us. It's going to go well and we're going to create change. And, you know, we want to help. We want to help. We want to create change and have resources to create change. And I think it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen. And but yeah, it does drive me crazy. Like, the question is, how does it feel? It's frustrating. We won the Federal Court of Appeal. They told us, your economic analysis is right. Canada's wrong, but we're still going to side of the best interest of Canada. So, okay, you won, but you lose. and that's the courts controlled. They're controlled, and our country is controlled. And it's leading in the direction for the rich to become richer and all this sort of stuff. And it's killing everything. 60% of mammals, 50% of the world's species, atmospheric rivers, 400 fires at one time in British Columbia. It's all these things are adding up, and we're still not making decisions as a nation, as a people, to do something. And what it comes down to sometimes, I just think when it, you know, it drives me nuts, but it's a lack of spirit, and that's what I hope people get. And the benefits of it are more than just trying to protect what we love, but why not? Why not love your family more? Why not love your wife more, your husband more? Why not love life more and get some happiness out of it instead of being like robots, like my son said, leaving his school in grade 2.
That was one of the things I actually wanted you to talk about a little bit, is your children, Kaya and Cedar, and how they've really taken on a role in activism and, you know, fighting for the land and the water, and they've both spoken at the UN. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you think their role in the future will be? Because they seem pretty determined to fight this fight with you.
When they're young, they didn't want to speak, and they said, no. And I should never be like you and mom and my ex-wife. And he said, no. But they did. They do really, really well. And they end up speaking, and they're both great, elegant, beautiful speakers, articulate. And, you know, they both spoke at United Nations about 5 times each. They quit doing that. They're not as much into the environmental work as they used to be. They do great work. And then they sort of grew up in the fight, so they support it any time. But my daughter, I took 2 years off from university, but it was good. She learned our native language, our Indigenous First Nation language here. And then she did a movie. She wrote, directed, produced it, and acted in this movie with no background in it. It was pretty neat. And the movie did really well and got some critical acclaim, and still going to film festivals around it. And she was offered to do a miniseries with National Geographic. So she loves that, but she's still she's back in university full time though. So she's struggling a little bit with her time. And other than that, she's doing really, really good. You know, she still makes time for ceremony a couple times a week. And my son too. He just did a 4-day ceremony with a whole bunch of friends from Mexico and from BC here. And he said, Dad, I'm on a spiritual high here. I'm going to do great work. And he works for the Wilderness Committee, who's been our ally from the very, very beginning, from 2010 to still till today, but now he works for them and is stopping glyphosate is really toxic to our environment. It's killing native species of trees and he's bringing awareness to it. He had a chief's meeting and getting chiefs on board and community on board and still does environmental things. He also works at helps foster kids connect to our ceremonies, the indigenous foster kids. And he loves both works and they're doing really well. My daughter lives up on the campus in SFU. My son lives right downtown in a beautiful apartment in the view of the mountain. And yeah, they're just great. I couldn't be happier, you know. And it's funny, I got a call like 5 years ago when I think my daughter's 18, my son is 20, around there, and somebody from San Francisco called and said, hey, we're having a really big conference here. And I said, oh, when? Oh, sorry, not you. We're just trying to see if your kids are available. And I was like, I can ask them. And I still get calls for them. I still get calls from them. Hey, can your kids do this? And I think it's great. You know, I'm not doing my job unless I'm teaching the people and in ceremony to surpass me. And in a lot of ways, they surpassed me. And I couldn't be prouder for that.
So in February 2020, you said reconciliation died when the federal court appeal decision came in. Where do you stand with everything now? Like, what else can you do? Like, what is the legal status? And is there anything else as you can do as this project just seems to continue to move forward?
Well, we're working still hard. Like, I shared the economic analysis that Eugene Kung worked with the economists. You know, where I explained that, you know, in the other pipeline, it's $11, and for this pipeline, it's $23. So we, from the very beginning, we've been saying it's a stranded asset. Now it is more so. So what I'm afraid of is they're going to eliminate the debt and maybe try to sell it to somebody. I hope it's not to First Nations because that'd be economic smallpox. You know, I think that's what they'll do is they'll try to eliminate the debt and try to sell it to somebody. And what we do is we discourage people from doing that, like the insurance companies. My kids were a big part of this and a lot of really great, beautiful people who work really hard. They got 17 out of insurance companies to get out of that. Were they still going after the bank, exposing what they're doing? And if investors come up, we encourage them with information that we could give them about doing their due diligence. And so we're still doing stuff. I did a ceremony. We're working on this religious spiritual movement. So I did a ceremony of 12 priests. I went to their church and we did a ceremony. Then they came to my sweat lodge and we did a ceremony. I'm going to do that with some rabbis. And we're looking out to a lot of the indigenous community here in Vancouver to try to push a spiritual movement to bring awareness to, because their teachings are the same as mine. So when we connect and our spirits fed, that we want to make this world a better place for our future generations. So those are a couple of things that we're working on in the media, you know, bringing more awareness. And it's a disaster, and you know, it's the whole project is a big eyesore and a big blow. And now it's going to be to the Liberal Party, and the election's coming up, so we're going to figure out a strategy around that as well. Those are just a couple of things we're working on.
Do you know if any of the indigenous groups more in the interior are dealing with the Trans Mountain Pipeline issues environmentally? Because when I drive from interior, the Coquihalla, the damage that's been done up there to the ecosystem is terrible. You see creeks have dried up. They've totally disrupted the ecosystem there. And I was just wondering if there's anybody fighting that fight.
Yeah, there's a couple nations up there, but there's more of the people that are fighting. You got the Tiny House Warriors, the Emanuel family, who we've been working with for 4 generations now. George Emanuel, J.D. Emanuel, and Art Emanuel, and now to myself and to my kids. There are some nations that we're still working with that are allies, of course.
Do you think that legally there's anything left, or is the legal battle done?
We're always looking at that. we're always looking at. There's things that we're looking at now that we wouldn't share right now until we solidify something. But we're always looking at something. We're always looking at it. It's like, but no, I don't think so.
Well, one of the things I'd like to ask you to do, if you're comfortable doing at the closing, because I think your story and your story of transition with ceremony and song and sweat and dancing is you know, such a beautiful story. I'm just wondering if you could sing a song about, you know, the land or the water to our listeners to close off with, so that's something they can carry in their heart.
Sure, sounds good. And love and blessings to all the people that are listening, and thank you for this, and I just hope that we can move together as one in our language. We say Natsuma. That's one heart, one mind, one prayer, one spirit together. So this is the Eagle Song from my grandfather, my Uncle Bob, and the Eagle's a messenger. What we believe is the Eagle can take our messages to our ancestors or to heaven. But, you know, this one verse of the song. Oh, hilo, hilo, oh, hilo, oh, hilo, hilo, oh, oh, ah, hila. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruben. All my relations, and I hope our listeners learn something from this and get inspired and join your fight to save the lands and waters. And
all right. You guys take care. Love and blessings to each and every one of you.
That's it for today. Do something great for this beautiful planet each and every day. To hear more Clean Tech podcasts, visit the Clean Tech and Climate Change page on Investor Ideas. You can find it on our top template. Also, Investor Ideas has a lineup of other podcasts and themes, including the AII, the Crypto Corner, our cannabis podcast called Cannabis News and Stocks on the Move, rated one of the top investor podcasts in the sector, Play by Play, a podcast looking at sports and esports news, and Exploring Mining. To listen to any of our podcasts, visit our podcast page on Investor Ideas at investorideas.com/audio. And a reminder, you can hear our podcasts on Spotify, iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spreaker.com, iHeartRadio, Google Play Music, and most audio platforms available to you. If you like any of our podcasts, we would appreciate you recommending them or reviewing them on your audio platform. And to help you follow and track clean tech and renewable energy stocks, Investor Ideas has created a directory of publicly traded stocks in the sector. You can find that by going to our homepage, looking on the sidebar and looking at renewable energy and environmental themes, and you'll find our stock directories there. Investor Ideas does remind all of investors to read our disclaimers and disclosures on our site. You can find them at investorideas.com/about-disclaimer.asp. It is important to read these. And this podcast is not an endorsement to buy products or services or securities. Investors are reminded that all investment involves risk and a possible loss of investment. Thank you again and have a great day.